clockwise direction. Joe uttered a hissing gasp, and Larry Underwood stirred a little in his sleep, turned over, and was quiet again. The knife fell to the grass between them, its serrated blade holding splintered reflections of the silver moon. They looked like luminous snowflakes. He stared at her with angry, reproachful, and distrusting eyes. Nadine stared back uncompromisingly. She pointed back the way they had come. Joe shook his head viciously. He pointed at the screen and the dark lump in the sleeping bag beyond the screen. He made a horribly explicit gesture, drawing his thumb across his throat at the Adam's apple. Then he grinned. Nadine had never seen him grin before, and it chilled her. It could not have been more savage if those gleaming white teeth had been filed to points. "No," she said softly, "or I'll wake him up now." Joe looked alarmed. He shook his head rapidly. "Then come back with me. Sleep." He looked down at the knife, then up at her again. The savagery, for now at least, was gone. He was only a lost little boy who wanted his teddy, or the scratchy blanket which had graduated with him from the crib. Nadine recognized vaguely that this might be the time to make him leave the knife, to just shake her head firmly, no. But then what? Would he scream? He had screamed after the lunatic soldier had passed out of sight. Screamed and screamed, huge inarticulate sounds of terror and rage. Did she want to meet the man in the sleeping bag at night, and with such screams ringing in her ears and his? "Will you come back with me?" Joe nodded. "All right," she said quietly. He bent quickly and picked it up. They went back together, and he crawled next to her trustingly, the interloper forgotten, at least temporarily. Wrapped his arms around her and went to sleep. She felt the old familiar ache in her belly, the one so much deeper and all-pervading than those caused by the exercise. It was a woman ache, and nothing could be done about it. She fell asleep. She woke up sometime in the early hours of the morning. She wore no watch, cold and stiff and terrified. Afraid suddenly that Joe had cunningly waited until she was asleep to creep back to the house and cut the man's throat in his sleep. Joe's arms were no longer around her. She felt responsible for the boy. She had always felt responsible for the little ones who had not asked to be in the world. But if he had done that, she would cut him adrift. To take life when so much had been lost was the one unpardonable sin. And she could not be alone with Joe much longer without help. Being with him was like being in a cage with a temperamental lion. Like a lion, Joe could not, or would not, speak. He could only roar in his lost little boy's voice. She sat up and saw that the boy was still with her. In his sleep, he had drawn away from her a little, that was all. He had curled up like a fetus, his thumb in his mouth, his hand wrapped around the shaft of the knife. Mostly asleep again already, she walked to the grass, urinated, and went back to her blanket. The next morning she was not sure if she had really awakened in the night or only dreamed she had. "If I dreamed," Larry thought, "they must have been good dreams." He couldn't remember any of them. He felt like his old self, and he thought today would be a good day. He would see the ocean today. He rolled up his sleeping bag, tied it to the bike carrier, went back to get his pack, and stopped. A cement path led up to the porch steps, and on both sides the grass was long and violently green. To the right, close by the porch itself, the dewy grass was beaten down. When the dew evaporated, the grass would spring back up, but now it held the shape of footprints. He was a city boy and no kind of woodsman. He had been more into Hunter Thompson than James Fenimore Cooper. But you would have to be blind, he thought, not to see by the tracks that there had been two of them, a big one and a small one. Sometime during the night they had come up to the screen and looked in at him. It gave him a chill. It was the stealth he didn't like, and he liked the first touch of returning fear even less. "If they don't show themselves pretty quick," he thought, "I'm going to try and flush them out." Just the thought that he could do that brought most of his self-confidence back. He slipped into his pack and got going. By noon he had reached US 1 in Wells. He flipped a coin and it came up tails. He turned south on one, leaving the coin to gleam indifferently up from the dust. Joe found it 20 minutes later and stared at it as if it were a hypnotist's crystal. He put it in his mouth, and Nadine made him spit it out. 2 miles down the road, Larry saw it for the first time, the huge blue animal, lazy and slow this day. It was completely different from the Pacific or the Atlantic that lay off Long Island. That part of the ocean looked complacent somehow, almost tame. This water was a darker blue, nearly cobalt, and it came up to the land in one rushing swell after another and bit at the rocks. Spume as thick as egg white jumped into the air and then splattered back. The waves made a constant growling boom against the shore. Larry parked his bike and walked toward the ocean, feeling a deep excitement that he couldn't explain. He was here. He had made it to the place where the sea took over. This was the end of East. This was Land's End. He crossed a marshy field, his shoes squishing through water standing around hummocks and clumps of reeds. There was a rich and fecund tidal smell. As he drew closer to the headland, the thin skin of earth was peeled away and the naked bone of granite poked through. Granite, Maine's final truth. Gulls rose, clean white against the blue sky, crying and wailing. He had never seen so many birds in one place before. It occurred to him that despite their white beauty, gulls were carrion eaters. The thought that followed was nearly unspeakable, but it had formed fully in his mind before he could push it away. The pickings must be real good just lately. He began to walk again, his shoes now clicking and scraping on sun-dried rock which would always be wet in its many seams from the spray. There were barnacles growing in those cracks, and scattered here and there like shrapnel bursts of bone were the shells the gulls had dropped to get at the soft meat inside. A moment later he stood upon the naked headland. The sea wind struck him full force, lifting his heavy growth of hair back from his forehead. He lifted his face into it, into the harsh, clean, salt smell of the blue animal. The combers, glassy blue-green, moved slowly in, their slopes becoming more pronounced as the bottom shallowed up beneath them, their peaks gaining first a curl of foam, then a curdly topping. Then they crashed suicidally against the rocks, as they had since the beginning of time, destroying themselves, destroying an infinitesimal bit of the land at the same time. There was a ramming, coughing boom as water was forced deep into some half-submerged channel of rock that had been carved out over the millennia. He turned first left, then right, and saw the same thing happening in each direction as far as he could see. Combers, waves, spray, most of all an endless glut of color that took his breath away. He was at Land's End. He sat down with his feet dangling over the edge, feeling a little overcome. He sat there for half an hour or better. The sea breeze honed his appetite and he rummaged in his pack for lunch. He ate heartily. Thrown spray had turned the legs of his blue jeans black. He felt cleaned out, fresh. He walked back across the marsh, still so full of his own thoughts that he first supposed the rising scream to be the gulls again. He had even started to look up at the sky before he realized with a nasty jolt of fear that it was a human scream, a war cry. His eyes jerked downward again, and he saw a young boy running across the road toward him, muscular legs pumping. In one hand he held a long butcher knife. He was naked except for underpants, and his legs were crisscrossed with bramble welts. Behind him, just coming out of the brush and nettles on the far side of the highway, was a woman. She looked pale, and there were circles of weariness under her eyes. "Joe!" she called, and then began to run as if it hurt her to do so. Joe came on, never heeding, his bare feet splashing up thin sheets of marsh water. His entire face was drawn back in a tight and murderous grin. The butcher knife was high over his head, catching the sun. "He's coming to kill me," Larry thought, entirely poleaxed by the idea. "This boy, what did I ever do to him?" "Joe!" the woman screamed, this time in a high, weary, despairing voice. Joe ran on, closing the distance. Larry had time to realize he had left his rifle with his bike, and then the screaming boy was upon him. As he brought the butcher knife down in a long, sweeping arc, Larry's paralysis broke. He stepped aside and, not even thinking, brought his right foot up and sent the wet yellow work boot it was wearing into the boy's midriff. And what he felt was pity. There was nothing to the kid. He went over like a candle pin. He looked fierce, but was no heavyweight. "Joe!" Nadine called. She tripped over a hummock and fell to her knees, splashing her white blouse with brown mud. "Don't hurt him! He's only a little boy! Please, don't hurt him!" She got to her feet and struggled on. Joe had fallen flat on his back. He was splayed out like an X, his arms making a V, his open legs making a second inverted V. Larry took a step forward and tromped on his right wrist, pinning the hand holding the knife to the muddy ground. "Let go of the sticker, kid." The boy hissed, and then made a grunting, gobbling sound like a turkey. His upper lip drew back from his teeth. His Chinese eyes glared into Larry's. Keeping his foot on the boy's wrist was like standing on a wounded but still vicious snake. He could feel the boy trying to yank his hand free, and never mind if it was at the expense of skin, flesh, or even a broken bone. He jerked into a half-sitting position and tried to bite Larry's leg through the heavy wet denim of his jeans. Larry stepped down even harder on the thin wrist, and Joe uttered a cry, not of pain, but defiance. "Let it go, kid!" Joe continued to struggle. The stalemate would have continued until Joe got the knife free or until Larry broke his wrist, if Nadine had not finally arrived, muddy, breathless, and staggering with weariness. Without looking at Larry, she dropped to her knees. "Let it go," she said quietly, but with great firmness. Her face was sweaty but calm. She held it only inches above Joe's contorted, twisting features. He snapped at her like a dog and continued to struggle. Grimly, Larry strove to keep his balance. If the boy got free now, he would probably strike at the woman first. "Let it go," Nadine said. The boy growled. Spit leaked between his clenched teeth. There was a smear of mud in the shape of a question mark on his right cheek. "We'll leave you, Joe. I'll leave you. I'll go with him, unless you're good." Larry felt a further tensing of the arm under his foot, then a loosening. But the boy was looking at her grievingly, accusingly, reproachfully. When he shifted his gaze slightly to look at Larry, Larry could read the hot jealousy in those eyes. Even with the sweat running off him in buckets, Larry felt cold under that stare. She continued to speak calmly. No one would hurt him. No one would leave him. If he let go of the knife, everyone could be friends. Gradually, Larry became aware that the hand under his shoe had relaxed and let go. The boy lay dormant, staring up at the sky. He had opted out. Larry took his foot off Joe's wrist, bent quickly, and picked up the knife. He turned and scaled it up and out toward the headland. The blade whirled and whirled, throwing off spears of sunlight. Joe's strange eyes followed its course, and he gave one long, hooting wail of pain. The knife bounced on the rocks with a thin clatter and skittered over the edge. Larry turned back and regarded them. The woman was still looking at Joe's right forearm, where the waffled shape of Larry's boot was deeply embedded and turning an angry, exclamatory red. Her dark eyes looked up from that to Larry's face. They were full of sorrow. Larry felt the old defensive and self-serving words rise. "I had to do it. It wasn't my fault. Listen, lady, he wanted to kill me." Because he thought he could read the judgment in those sorrowing eyes. "You ain't no nice guy." But in the end he said nothing. The situation was what the situation was, and his actions had been forced by the kids. Looking at the boy, who now curled himself up desolately over his own knees and put a thumb in his mouth, he doubted if the boy himself had initiated the situation. And it could have ended in a worse way, with one of them cut or even killed. So he said nothing, and he met the woman's soft gaze and thought, "I think I've changed. Somehow. I don't know how much." He found himself thinking of something Barry Grieg had once said to him about a rhythm guitar player from L.A., a guy named Jory Baker, who was always on time, never missed a practice session, or fucked up an audition. Not the kind of guitar player that caught your eye, no showboat like Angus Young or Eddie Van Halen, but competent. Once, Barry had said, Jory Baker had been the driving wheel of a group called Sparks, a group everybody seemed to think that year's most likely to succeed. They had a sound something like early Creedence, hard, solid guitar rock and roll. Jory Baker had done most of the writing and all of the vocals. Then a car accident, broken bones, lots of dope in the hospital. He had come out, as the John Prine song says, with a steel plate in his head and a monkey on his back. He progressed from Demerol to heroin. Got busted a couple of times. After a while he was just another street druggie with fumble fingers, spare changing down at the Greyhound station and hanging out on the strip. Then somehow, over a period of 18 months, he had gotten clean and stayed clean. A lot of him was gone. He was no longer the driving wheel of any group, most likely to succeed or otherwise, but he was always on time, never missed a practice session, or fucked up an audition. He didn't talk much, but the needle highway on his left arm had disappeared. And Barry Grieg had said, "He's come out the other side." That was all. No one can tell what goes on in between the person you were and the person you become. No one can chart that blue and lonely section of hell. There are no maps of the change. You just come out the other side. Or you don't. "I've changed somehow," Larry thought dimly. "I've come out the other side, too." She said, "I'm Nadine Cross. This is Joe. I'm happy to meet you." "Larry Underwood." They shook hands, both smiling faintly at the absurdity. "Let's walk back to the road," Nadine said. They started off side by side, and after a few steps, Larry looked back over his shoulder at Joe, who was still sitting over his knees and sucking his thumb, apparently unaware they were gone. "He'll come," she said quietly. "Are you sure?" "Quite sure." As they came to the highway's gravel shoulder, she stumbled, and Larry took her arm. She looked at him gratefully. "Can we sit down?" she asked.
"Sure."
So they sat down on the pavement, facing each other. After a little bit, Joe got up and plodded toward them, looking down at his bare feet. He sat a little way apart from them. Larry looked at him warily, then back at Nadine Cross.
"You were the two following me."
"You knew?"
"Yes, I thought you did."
"How long?"
2 days now," Nadine said. "We were staying in the big house at Epsom." Seeing his puzzled expression, she added, "By the creek. You fell asleep by the rock wall."
He nodded.
"And last night the two of you came to peek at me while I was sleeping on that porch, maybe to see if I had horns or a long red tail."
"That was Joe," she said quietly. "I came after him when I found he was gone."
"How did you know?"
"You left tracks in the dew."
"Oh."
She looked at him closely, examining him, and although he wanted to, Larry didn't drop his eyes.
"I don't want you to be angry with us. I suppose that sounds ridiculous after Joe just tried to kill you, but Joe isn't responsible."
"Is that his real name?"
"No, just what I call him."
"He's like a savage in a National Geographic TV show."
"Yes, just like that. I found him on the lawn of a house. His house, maybe. The name was Rockway. Sick from a bite. A rat bite, maybe. He doesn't talk. He growls and grunts. Until this morning I've been able to control him, but I'm tired, you see, and..."
She shrugged. Marsh mud was drying on her blouse in what could have been a series of Chinese ideograms.
"I dressed him at first. He took everything off but his underpants. Eventually I got tired of trying. The minges and mosquitoes don't seem to bother him."
She paused.
"I want us to come with you. I guess there is no way to be coy about it under the circumstances."
Larry wondered what she would think if he told her about the last woman who had wanted to come with him. Not that he ever would. That episode was deeply buried, even if the woman in question was not. He was no more anxious to bring up Rita than a murderer would be to drag his victim's name into parlor conversation.
"I don't know where I'm going," he said. "I came up from New York City, the long way around, I guess. The plan was to find a nice house on the coast and just lie up there until October or so. But the longer I go, the more I want other people.
The longer I go, the more all of this seems to hit me.
He was expressing himself badly and didn't seem to be able to do better without bringing up Rita or his bad dreams about the dark man.
"I've been scared a lot of the time," he said carefully, "because I'm on my own. Pretty paranoid. It's like I expected Indians to just swoop down and scalp me."
"In other words, you've stopped looking for houses and started looking for people."
"Yes, maybe."
"You found us. That's a start."
"I do believe you found me. And that boy worries me, Nadine. I have to be upfront about that. His knife's gone, but the world is full of knives just lying around waiting to be picked up."
"Yes."
"I don't want to sound brutal."
He trailed off, hoping she would say it for him, but she said nothing at all, only looked at him with those dark eyes.
"Would you consider leaving him?"
There it was, spat out like a lump of rock, and he still didn't sound like much of a nice guy.
But was it right? Was it fair to either of them? To make a bad situation worse by burdening themselves with a 10-year-old psychopath?
He had told her he was going to sound brutal, and he supposed he had. But they were in a brutal world now.
Meanwhile, Joe's odd seawater-colored eyes bored into him.
"I couldn't do that," Nadine said calmly. "I understand the danger, and I understand that the danger would be primarily to you. He's jealous. He's afraid that you might become more important to me than he is. He might very well try to get at you again unless you can make friends with him, or at least convince him you don't mean to..."
She trailed off, leaving that part vague.
"But if I left him, that would be the same as murder, and I won't be a party to that. Too many have died to kill more."
"If he cuts my throat in the middle of the night, you'll be a party to that."
She bowed her head.
Speaking so quietly that only she could hear, he didn't know if Joe, who was watching them, understood what they were talking about or not. Larry said,
"He probably would have done it last night if you hadn't come after him. Isn't that the truth?"
Softly, she replied, "Those are things that might be."
Larry laughed.
"The ghost of Christmas yet to come?"
She looked up.
"I want to come with you, Larry, but I can't leave Joe. You will have to decide."
"You don't make it easy."
"These days, it's no easy life."
He thought about it. Joe sat on the soft shoulder of the road, watching them with his seawater eyes. Behind them, the real sea moved restlessly against the rocks, booming in its secret channels where it had infiltrated the land.
"All right," he said. "I think you're being dangerously soft-hearted, but all right."
"Thank you," Nadine said. "I will be responsible for his actions."
"That will be a great comfort if he kills me."
"That would be on my heart for the rest of my life," Nadine said. And a sudden certainty that all her words about the sanctity of life would someday not too distant rise up to mock her swept her like a cold wind, and she shuddered.
"No," she told herself, "I'll not kill. Not that. Never that."
They camped that night on the soft white sand of the Wells public beach. Larry built a large fire above the strand of kelp that marked the last high tide, and Joe sat on the other side, away from him and Nadine, feeding small sticks into the blaze. Occasionally he would hold a bigger stick into the flames until it caught like a torch, and then tear away down the sand, holding it aloft like a single flaming birthday candle. They were able to see him until he was beyond the 30-foot glow of the fire, and then only his moving torch, drawn back in the wind manufactured by his wild sprinting. The sea breeze had come up a little, and it was cooler than it had been for days. Vaguely, Larry remembered the spell of rain that had occurred the afternoon he had found his mother dying, just before the superflu had hit New York like a highballing freight train. Remembered the thunderstorm and the white curtains blowing wildly into the apartment. He shivered a little, and the wind danced a spiral of fire out of the fire and up toward the black starshot sky. Embers cycloned up even higher and flickered out. He thought of fall, still distant but not so far as it had been on that day in June when he had discovered his mother lying on the floor, delirious. He shivered a little.
North, far down on the beach, Joe's torch bobbed up and down. It made him feel lonely, and all the colder. That single light flickering in the large and silent darkness. The surf rolled and boomed. "Do you play?" He jumped a little at her voice and looked at the guitar case lying beside them on the sand. It had been leaning against a Steinway piano in the music room of the big house they had broken into to get their supper. He had loaded his pack with enough cans to replace what they had eaten this day, and had taken the guitar on impulse, not even looking inside the case to see what it was. Coming from a house like that, it was probably a good un. He hadn't played since that crazy Malibu party, and that had been 6 weeks ago. In another life. "Yeah, I do," he said, and discovered that he wanted to play, not for her, but because sometimes it felt good to play. It eased your mind. And when you had a bonfire on the beach, someone was supposed to play the guitar. That was practically graven in stone. "Let's see what we got here," he said, and unsnapped the catches. He had expected something good, but what lay inside the case was still a happy surprise. It was a Gibson 12-string, a beautiful instrument, perhaps even custom-made. Larry wasn't enough of a judge of guitars to be sure. He did know that the fretboard inlays were real mother-of-pearl, catching reddish-orange glints from the fire and waxing them into prisms of light. "It's beautiful," she said. "It sure is." He strummed it and liked the sound it made, even open and not quite in tune. The sound was fuller and richer than the sound you got from a 6-string. A harmonic sound, but tough. That was the good thing about a steel-string guitar. You got a nice, tough sound. And the strings were black diamonds, wrapped and a little hokey, but you got an honest sound, a trifle rough when you changed chords. Zing. He smiled a little, remembering Barry Grieg's contempt for the smooth, flat guitar strings. He had always called them dollar slicks. Good old Barry, who wanted to be Steve Miller when he grew up. "What are you smiling about?" Nadine asked. "Old times," he said, and felt a little sad. He tuned by ear, getting it just right, still thinking about Barry and Johnny McCall and Wayne Stuckey. As he was finishing, she tapped him lightly on the shoulder, and he looked up. Joe was standing by the fire, a burned-out stick held forgotten in one hand. Those strange eyes were staring at him with frank fascination, and his mouth was open. Very quietly, so quietly that it might have been a thought in his own head, Nadine said, "Music hath charms." Larry began to pick out a rough melody on the guitar, an old blues he had picked up off an electro-folk album as a teenager. Something originally done by Kerner, Ray, and Glover, he thought. When he thought he had the melody right, he let it walk off down the beach and then sang. His singing was always going to be better than his playing. "Well, you see me coming, baby, from a long ways away. I will turn the night mama right into day, 'cause I'm here. A long ways from my home, but you can hear me coming, baby, by the slapping on my black cat bone." The boy was grinning now. Grinning in an amazed way of someone who has discovered a glad secret. Larry thought he looked like someone who had been suffering from an unreachable itch between his shoulder blades for a long, long time, and had finally found someone who knew exactly where to scratch. He scruffed through long unused archives of memory, hunting a second verse, and found one. "I can do some things, Mama, that other men can't do. They can't find the numbers, baby, can't work the conqueror route. But I can, 'cause I'm a long way from my home, and you know you'll hear me comin' by the whackin' on my black cat bone." The boy's open, delighted grin lit those eyes up, made them into something, Larry realized, that would be apt to make the muscles in any young girl's thighs loosen a little. He reached for an instrumental bridge and fumbled through it, not too badly either. His fingers wrung the right sounds out of the guitar, hard, flashy, a little bit tawdry, like a display of junk jewelry, probably stolen, sold out of a paper bag on a street corner. He made it swagger a little, and then retreated quickly to a good old three-finger E before he could fuck it all up. He couldn't remember all of the last verse, something about a railroad track, so he repeated the first verse again and quit. When the silence hit again,
Nadine laughed and clapped her hands. Joe threw his stick away and jumped up and down on the sand, making fierce hooting sounds of joy. Larry couldn't believe the change in the kid and had to caution himself not to make too much of it. To do so would be to risk disappointment. Music hath charms to soothe the savage beast. He found himself wondering with unwilling distrust if it could be something as simple as that. Joe was gesturing at him, and Nadine said, "He wants you to play something else. Would you? That was wonderful. It makes me feel better. So much better." So he played Jeff Muldar's Goin' Downtown and his own Sally's Fresno Blues. He played the Spring Hill Mine Disaster and Arthur Crudup's That's All Right, Mama. He switched to primitive rock and roll, Milk Cow Blues, Jim Dandy, 20 Flight Rock, doing the boogie-woogie rhythm of the chorus as well as he could, although his fingers were getting slow and numb and painful by now. And finally a song he had always liked, Endless Sleep, originally done by Jody Reynolds. "I can't play anymore," he said to Joe, who had stood without moving through this entire recital. "My fingers." He held them out, showing the deep grooves the strings had made in his fingers and the chips in his nails. The boy held out his own hands. Larry paused for a moment, then shrugged inside. He handed the guitar to the boy neck first. "It takes a lot of practice," he said. But what followed was the most amazing thing he had ever heard in his life. The boy struck up Jim Dandy almost flawlessly, hooting at the words rather than singing them, as if his tongue was plastered to the roof of his mouth. At the same time, it was perfectly obvious that he had never played a guitar in his life before. He couldn't bear down hard enough on the strings to make them ring out properly, and his chord changes were slurred and sloppy. The sound that came out was muted and ghostly, as if Joe was playing a guitar stuffed full of cotton, but otherwise it was a perfect carbon copy of the way Larry had played the tune. When he had finished, Joe looked curiously down at his own fingers, as if trying to understand why they could make the substance of the music Larry had played, but not the sharp sounds themselves. Numbly, as if from a distance, Larry heard himself say, "You're not bearing down hard enough, that's all. You have to build up calluses, hard spots on the ends of your fingers, and the muscles in your left hand, too." Joe looked at him closely as he spoke, but Larry didn't know if the boy really understood or not. He turned to Nadine. "Did you know he could do that?" "No. I'm as surprised as you are. It's as if he is a prodigy or something, isn't it?" Larry nodded. The boy ran through That's All Right, Mama, again getting almost every nuance of the way Larry had played it. But the strings sometimes thudded like wood as Joe's fingers blocked the vibration of the strings rather than making it come true. "Let me show you," Larry said, and held out his hands for the guitar. Joe's eyes immediately slanted down with distrust. Larry thought he was remembering the knife going down into the sea. He backed away, holding the guitar tightly. "All right," Larry said. "All yours. When you want a lesson, come see me." The boy made a hooting sound and ran off along the beach, holding the guitar high over his head like a sacrificial offering. "He's gonna smash it to hell," Larry said. "No," Nadine answered. "I don't think he is." Larry woke up sometime in the night and propped himself up on one elbow. Nadine was only a vaguely female shape wrapped up in three blankets a quarter of the way around the dead fire. Directly across from Larry was Joe. He was also under several blankets, but his head stuck out. His thumb was corked securely in his mouth. His legs were drawn up, and between them was the body of the Gibson 12-string. His free hand was wrapped loosely around the guitar's neck. Larry stared at him, fascinated. He had taken the boy's knife and thrown it away. The boy had adopted the guitar. Fine, let him have it. You couldn't stab anybody to death with a guitar, although Larry supposed it would make a pretty fair blunt instrument. He dropped off to sleep again. When he woke up the next morning, Joe was sitting on a rock with the guitar on his lap and his bare feet in the run of the surf, playing Sally's Fresno Blues. He had gotten better. Nadine woke up 20 minutes later and smiled at him radiantly. It occurred to Larry that she was a lovely woman, and a snatch of song occurred to him, something by Chuck Berry. "Nadine, honey, is that you?" Aloud, he said, "Let's see what we've got for breakfast."
He built up the fire, and the three of them sat close to it, working the night chill out of their bones. Nadine made oatmeal with powdered milk, and they drank a strong tea brewed in a can, hobo fashion. Joe ate with the Gibson across his lap. And twice Larry found himself smiling at the boy and thinking you couldn't not like someone who liked the guitar. They cycled south on US-1. Joe rode his bike straight down the white line, sometimes ranging as far as a mile ahead. Once they caught up to him, placidly walking his bike along the verge of the road and eating blackberries in an amusing way. He would toss each berry into the air, unerringly catching them in his mouth as they came down. An hour after that, they found him seated on a historic Revolutionary War marker and playing Jim Dandy on the guitar. Just before 11 o'clock, they came to a bizarre roadblock at the town line of a place called Agunquit. Three bright orange town dump trucks were driven across the road, blocking it from shoulder to shoulder. Sprawled in the back of one of the dump bins was the crow-picked body of what had once been a man. The last 10 days of solid heat had done their work. Where the body was not clothed, a fever of maggots boiled. Nadine turned away.
"Where's Joe?" she asked.
"I don't know. Somewhere up ahead."
"I wish he hadn't seen that. Do you think he did?"
"Probably," Larry said. He had been thinking that for a main artery, Route 1 had been awfully deserted ever since they left Wells, with no more than 2 dozen stalled cars along the way. Now he understood why. They had blocked the road. There would probably be hundreds, maybe thousands of cars stacked up on the far side of this town. He knew how she felt about Joe. It would have been good to spare the boy this.
"Why did they block the road?" she asked him. "Why would they do that?"
"They must have tried to quarantine their town. I imagine we'll find another roadblock on the other end."
"Are there other bodies?"
Larry put his bike on its stand and looked. "3, he said.
"All right. I'm not going to look at them."
He nodded. They wheeled their bikes past the trucks and then rode on. The highway had turned close to the sea again, and it was cooler. Summer cottages were jammed together in long and sordid rows. People took their vacations in those tenements, Larry wondered. Why not just go to Harlem and let your kids play under the hydrant spray?
"Not very pretty, are they?" Nadine asked.
On either side of them, the essence of honky-tonk beach resort had now enclosed them. Gas stations, fried clam stands, dairy treats, motels painted in feverish pastel colors, mini-golf. Larry was drawn two painful ways by these things. Part of him clamored at their sad and blatant ugliness and at the ugliness of the mines that had turned this section of a magnificent savage coastline into one long highway amusement park for families in station wagons. But there was a more subtle, deeper part of him that whispered of the people who had filled these places and this road during other summers. Ladies in sun hats and shorts too tight for their large behinds. College boys in red and black striped rugby shirts. Girls in beach shifts and thong sandals. Small screaming children with ice cream spread over their faces. They were American people, and there was a kind of dirty, compelling romance about them whenever they were in groups. Never mind if the group was in an Aspen ski lodge or performing their prosaic arcane rites of summer along US-1 in Maine. And now all those Americans were gone. A thunderstorm had ripped a branch from a tree and it had knocked the gigantic plastic dairy treat sign into the ice cream stand's parking lot, where it lay on its side like a pallid dunce cap. The grass was starting to get long on the mini golf course. This stretch of highway between Portland and Portsmouth had once been a 70-mile amusement park, and now it was only a haunted funhouse where all the clockwork had run down.
"Not very pretty, no," he said. "But once it was ours, Nadine. Once it was ours, even though we were never here before. Now it's gone."
"But not forever," she said calmly, and he looked at her clean and shining face. Her forehead, from which her amazing white-streaked hair was drawn back, glowed like a lamp.
I am not a religious person, but if I was, I would call what has happened a judgment of God. In 100 years, maybe 200, it will be ours again.
Those trucks won't be gone in 200 years.
No, but the road will be. The trucks will be standing in the middle of a field or a forest, and there will be lousewort and lady's slipper growing where their tires used to be. They won't really be trucks anymore. They will be artifacts.
I think you're wrong.
How can I be wrong?
Because we're looking for other people, Larry said. Now why do you think we're doing that?
She gazed at him, troubled.
Well, because it's the right thing to do, she said. People need other people. Didn't you feel that when you were alone?
Yes, Larry said.
If we don't have each other, we go crazy with loneliness. When we do, we go crazy with togetherness. When we get together, we build miles of summer cottages and kill each other in the bars on Saturday night.
He laughed. It was a cold and unhappy sound with no humor in it at all. It hung on the deserted air for a long time.
There's no answer. It's like being stuck inside an egg. Come on, Joe will be way ahead of us.
She stood astride her bike a moment longer, her troubled gaze on Larry's back as it pulled away. Then she rode after him. He couldn't be right. Couldn't be. If such a monstrous thing as this had happened for no good reason at all, what sense did anything make? Why were they even still alive?
Joe wasn't so far ahead after all. They came upon him sitting on the back bumper of a blue Ford parked in a driveway. He was looking at a girly magazine he had found somewhere, and Larry observed uncomfortably that the boy had an erection. He shot a glance at Nadine, but she was looking elsewhere, perhaps on purpose. When they reached the driveway, Larry asked, "Coming?" Joe put the magazine aside and, instead of standing up, made a guttural interrogative sound and pointed up in the air. Larry glanced up wildly, for a moment thinking the boy had seen an airplane. Then Nadine cried, "Not the sky, the barn!" Her voice was close and tight with excitement. "On the barn! Thank God for you, Joe. We never would have seen it." She went to Joe, put her arms around him, and hugged him. Larry turned to the barn, where white letters stood out clearly on the faded shingle roof. "Have gone to Stovington, Vermont Plague Center." Below that were a series of road directions, and at the bottom, "Leaving Ogunquit July 2, 1990. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith."
"Jesus Christ, his ass must have been out to the wind when he put that last line on," Larry said.
"The Plague Center," Nadine said, ignoring him. "Why didn't I think of it? I read an article about it in the Sunday Supplement magazine not 3 months ago. They've gone there."
"If they're still alive."
"Still alive? Of course they are. The plague was over by July 2nd. And if they could climb up on that barn roof, they surely weren't feeling sick."
"One of them was surely feeling pretty frisky," Larry agreed, feeling a half-reluctant excitement building in his own stomach.
"And to think I came right across Vermont."
"Stovington is north of Highway 9 by quite a ways," Nadine said absently, still looking up at the barn.
"Still, they must be there by now. July 2nd was 2 weeks ago today."
Her eyes were alight.
"Do you think there might be others at that plague center, Larry? There might be, don't you think? Since they know all about quarantines and sterile clothing, they would have been working on a cure, wouldn't they?"
"I don't know," Larry said cautiously.
"Of course they would," she said impatiently and a trifle wildly. Larry had never seen her so excited, not even when Joe performed his amazing feat of mimicry on the guitar. "I'll bet Harold and Francis have found dozens of people, maybe hundreds. We'll go right away. The quickest route—"
"Wait a minute," Larry said, taking her by the shoulder.
"What do you mean, wait? Do you realize—"
"I realize that sign's waited 2 weeks for us to come by, and this can wait a little longer. In the meantime, let's have some lunch. And old Joe the guitar-picking fool is falling asleep on his feet."
She glanced around. Joe was looking at the girly magazine again, but he had started to nod and blink over it in a glassy way. There were circles under his eyes.
"You said he just got over an infection," Larry said. "And you've done a lot of hard traveling, too, not to mention stalking the blue-eyed guitar player."
"You're right. I never thought."
All he needs is a good meal and a good nap.
Of course. Joe, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking.
Joe made a sleepy and mostly disinterested grunt.
Larry felt a lump of residual fear rise up in him at what he had to say next, but it ought to be said. If he didn't, Nadine would as soon as she had a chance to think. And besides, it was time maybe to find out if he had changed as much as he thought.
Nadine, can you drive?
Drive? Do you mean do I have a license?
Yes, but a car really isn't that practical with all the stalls in the road, is it?
I mean, I wasn't thinking about a car, he said, and the image of Rita riding pillion behind the mysterious black man, his mind's symbolic representation of death, he supposed, suddenly rose up behind his eyes, the two of them dark and pale, bearing down on him astride a monstrous Harley hog like weird horsemen of the apocalypse. The thought dried out the moisture in his mouth and made his temples pound, but when he went on, his voice was steady. If there was a break in it, Nadine did not seem to notice. Oddly, it was Joe who looked up at him out of his half-doze, seeming to notice some change.
I was thinking about motorbikes of some kind. We could make better time with less effort and walk them around any, well, any messes in the road. Like we walked our bikes around those town trucks back there.
Dawning excitement in her eyes.
Yes, we could do that. I've never driven one, but you could show me what to do, couldn't you?
At the words, I've never driven one, Larry's dread intensified.
Yes, he said, but most of what I'd teach you would be to drive slowly until you get the hang of it. Very slowly.
A motorcycle, even a little motorbike, doesn't forgive human error, and I can't take you to a doctor if you get wrecked up on the highway.
Then that's what we'll do. We'll... Larry, were you riding a cycle before we came across you? You must have been to make it up here from New York City so quickly.
I ditched it, he said steadily. I got nervous about riding alone.
Well, you won't be alone anymore, Nadine said almost gaily. She whirled to Joe.
We're going to Vermont, Joe. We're going to see some other people. Isn't that nice? Isn't it just great?
Joe yawned.
Nadine said she was too excited to sleep, but she would lie down with Joe until he was under. Larry rode into Ogunquit to look for a motorcycle dealership. There was none, but he thought that he had seen a cycle shop on their way out of Wells. He went back to tell Nadine and found them both asleep in the shade of the blue Ford where Joe had been perusing Gallery. He lay down a little way from them but couldn't sleep. At last he crossed the highway and made his way through the knee-high timothy grass to the barn where the sign was painted. Thousands of grasshoppers jumped wildly to get out of his way as he walked toward them, and Larry thought, I'm their plague. I'm their dark man. Near the barn's wide double doors, he spotted two empty Pepsi cans and a crust of sandwich. In more normal times, the gulls would have had the remains of sandwich long ago, but times had changed, and the gulls were no doubt used to richer food. He towed the crust, then one of the cans.
Get these right down to the crime lab, Sergeant Briggs. I think our killer has finally made a mistake.
Righto, Inspector Underwood. The day Scotland Yard decided to send you was a lucky day for Squinchley on the Green.
Don't mention it, Sergeant, all part of the job.
Larry went inside. It was dark, hot, and alive with the soft whirring wings of the barn swallows. The smell of hay was sweet. There were no animals in the stalls. The owner must have let them out to live or die with the superflu rather than face certain starvation.
Mark that down for the coroner's inquest, Sergeant.
I will indeed, Inspector Underwood.
He glanced down at the floor and saw a candy wrapper. He picked it up. A chocolate payday candy bar had once been stowed inside it. The sign painter had had guts, maybe. Good taste? No. Anyone with a taste for chocolate paydays had been spending too much time in the hot sun. Steps leading to the loft were nailed to one of the loft's supporting beams. Greasy with sweat already, not even knowing why he was here, Larry climbed up. In the center of the loft, he was walking slowly and keeping an eye out for rats. A more conventional flight of stairs went up to the cupola, and these stairs were splattered with drips of white paint.
We've stumbled on another find, I believe, Sergeant.
Inspector, I stand amazed. Your deductive acumen is exceeded only by your good looks and the extraordinary length of your reproductive organ.
Don't mention it, Sergeant.
He went up to the cupola. It was even hotter up here, explosively so, and Larry reflected that if Francis and Harold had left their paint up here when the job was done, the barn would have burned merrily to the ground a week ago. The windows were dusty and festooned with decaying cobwebs, which had no doubt been freshly spun when Gerald Ford was president. One of these windows had been forced up, and when Larry leaned out, he had a breathtaking view of the country for miles around. This side of the barn faced east, and he was high enough for the roadside concessions, which seemed so monstrously ugly when seen at ground level, to look as inconsequential as a little strewing of roadside litter. Beyond the highway, magnificent, was the ocean, with the incoming waves neatly broken in two by the breakwater stretching out from the northern side of the harbor. The land was an oil painting depicting high summer, all green and gold, wrapped in a still haze of afternoon. He could smell salt and brine. And looking down along the slope of the roof, he could read Harold's sign, upside down. Just the thought of crawling around on that roof so high above the ground made Larry's guts feel dauncy. And he really must have hung his legs right over the rain gutter to get the girl's name on.
Why did he go to the trouble, Sergeant? That, I think, is one of the questions to which we must address ourselves.
If you say so, Inspector Underwood.
He went back down the stairs, going slowly and watching his footing. This was no time for a broken leg. At the bottom, something else caught his eye. Something carved into one of the support beams, startlingly white and fresh and in direct contrast to all the rest of the barn's old dusty darkness. He went over to the beam and peered at the carving, then ran the ball of his thumb over it, part in amusement, part in wonder that another human being had done it on the day he and Rita had been trekking north. He ran his nail along the carved letters again. H-L-L-F-G. In a heart, with an arrow.
I believe, Sergeant, that the bloke must have been in love.
Good for you, Harold, Larry said, and left the barn.
The cycle shop in Wells was a Honda dealership, and from the way the showroom bikes were lined up, Larry deduced that two of them were missing. He was more proud of a second find, a crumpled candy wrapper near one of the waste baskets. A chocolate payday. It looked as if someone, lovesick Harold Lauder probably, had finished his candy bar while deciding which bikes he and his inamorata would be happiest with. He had balled up his wrapper and shot it at the wastebasket, and missed. Nadine thought his deductions were good, but she was not as fetched by them as Larry was. She was eyeing the remaining bikes, in a fever to be off. Joe sat on the showroom's front step, playing the Gibson 12-string and hooting contentedly. "Listen," Larry said, "it's 5 o'clock now, Nadine. There's absolutely no way to get going until tomorrow."
"But there's 3 hours of daylight left. We can't just sit around. We might miss them."
"If we miss them, that's that," he said. "Harold Lauder left instructions once, right down to the roads they were going to take. If they move on, he'll probably do it again."
"But I know you're anxious," he said, and put his hands on her shoulders. He could feel the old impatience building up and forced himself to control it.
"But you've never been on a motorcycle before."
"I can ride a bike, though, and I know how to use a clutch. I told you that. Please, Larry, if we don't waste time, we can camp in New Hampshire tonight and be halfway there by tomorrow night.
It's not like a bike, goddammit," he burst out, and the guitar came to a jangling stop behind him. He could see Joe looking back at them over his shoulder, his eyes narrowed and instantly distrustful. "Gee, I sure do have a way with people," Larry thought. That made him even angrier. Nadine said mildly,
"You're hurting me."
He looked and saw that his fingers were buried in the soft flesh of her shoulders, and his anger collapsed into dull shame. "I'm sorry," he said. Joe was still looking at him, and Larry recognized that he had just lost half the ground he had gained with the boy. Maybe more. Nadine had said something.
"What?"
"I said, tell me why it's not like a bike."
His first impulse was to shout at her, "If you know so much, go on and try it. See how you like looking at the world with your head on backward." He controlled that, thinking it wasn't only the boy he had lost ground with. He'd lost some with himself. Maybe he had come out the other side, but some of the old childish Larry had come out with him, tagging along at his heels like a shadow which has shrunk in the noonday sun, but has not entirely disappeared. "They're heavier," he said. "If you overbalance, you can't get rebalanced as easily as you can with a bicycle. One of these 360s goes 350 pounds. You get used to controlling that extra weight very quickly, but it does take some getting used to. In a standard shift car, you operate the gear shift with your hand and the throttle with your foot. On a cycle, it's reversed. The gear shift is foot-operated, the throttle hand-operated, and that takes a lot of getting used to. There are two brakes instead of one. Your right foot brakes the rear wheel, your right hand brakes the front wheel. If you forget and just use the handbrake, you're apt to fly right over the handlebars. And you're going to have to get used to your passenger."
"Joe? But I thought he'd ride with you."
"I'd be glad to take him," Larry said, "but right now I don't think he'd have me. Do you?" Nadine looked at Joe for a long, troubled time.
"No," she said, and then sighed.
"He may not even want to ride with me. It may scare him."
"If he does, you're going to be responsible for him, and I'm responsible for both of you. I don't want to see you spill."
"Did that happen to you, Larry? Were you with someone?"
"I was," Larry said, "and I took a spill, but by then the lady I was with was already dead."
"She crashed her motorcycle?" Nadine's face was very still.
"No. What happened, I'd say it was 70% accident and 30% suicide. Whatever she needed from me, friendship, understanding, help, I don't know, she wasn't getting enough."
He was upset now, his temples pounding thickly, his throat tight, the tears close.
"Her name was Rita. Rita Blakemore. I'd like to do better by you, that's all. You and Joe."
"Larry, why didn't you tell me before?"
"Because it hurts to talk about it," he said simply. "It hurts a lot."
That was the truth, but not the whole truth. There were the dreams. He found himself wondering if Nadine had bad dreams. Last night he had awakened briefly and she had been tossing restlessly and muttering. But she had said nothing today. And Joe, did Joe have bad dreams? Well, he didn't know about them, but fearless Inspector Underwood of Scotland Yard was afraid of the dreams. And if Nadine took a spill on the motorcycle, they might come back.
"We'll go tomorrow then," she said. "Teach me how tonight."
But first there was the matter of getting the two small bikes Larry had picked out gassed up. The dealership had a pump, but without electricity it wouldn't run. He found another candy wrapper by the plate covering the underground tank, and deduced that it had recently been pried up by the ever-resourceful Harold Lauder. Lovesick or no, payday freak or not, Larry had gained a lot of respect for Harold, almost a liking in advance. He had already developed his own mental picture of Harold. Probably in his mid-30s, a farmer maybe, tall and suntanned, skinny, not too bright in the book sense maybe, but plenty canny. He grinned. Building up a mental picture of someone you had never seen was a fool's game because they were never the way you had imagined. Everybody knows the one about the 300-pound disc jockey with the whipcord thin voice. While Nadine got a cold supper together, Larry prowled around the side of the dealership. There he found a large steel waste can. Leaning against it was a crowbar, and curling over the top was a piece of rubber tubing.
"I've found you again, Harold. Take a look at this, Sergeant Briggs. Our man siphoned some gas from the underground tank to get going. I'm surprised he didn't take his hose with him."
"Perhaps he cut off a piece and that's what's left, Inspector Underwood. Begging your pardon, but it is in the waste can."
"By Jove, Sergeant, you're right. I'm going to write you up for a promotion."
He took the crowbar and rubber hose back around to the plate covering the tank.
"Joe, can you come here for a minute and help me?"
The boy looked up from the cheese and crackers he was eating and gazed distrustfully at Larry.
"Go on now, that's all right," Nadine said quietly.
Joe came over, his feet dragging a little. Larry slipped the crowbar into the plate's slot. "Throw your weight on that and let's see if we can get it up," he said. For a moment, he thought